according to Hoyle.
What I can assert without fear of being challenged, I think, is that we could take the structure as it was originally erected in the 3rd millennium BC at Stonehenge and use it ourselves to predict eclipses of the sun. And I believe it because I think they probably had the sun and moon as divinities. And if that were true, then the eclipse of one's gods and goddesses would seem a very fundamental aspect of the universe. You'd seem to be digging very deep in the way that modern physicists believe they're digging very deep. And people would be very excited about it, just the way the modern physicist is excited if he suddenly turns up a radically new way in which the universe seems to fit together.
Professor Sir Fred Hoyle, through his own eyes and those of his colleagues.
His ideas and their consequences have become such an accepted and obvious part of the modern background of today's work that many people are actually unaware of their genesis.
Fred has always remained the Yorkshireman, fond of cricket, blunt speaking, and a cup of tea once an hour.
Fred has always been, ever since the first work that I ever knew of his, a completely original person, the starter of new ideas.
Fred has, in my mind, been more influential than any other living astronomer in setting man's view about his contemporary universe.
Professor Sir Fred Hoyle, now just turned 60, lives high on the Cumbrian hills of England in a converted farmhouse, where he talked to James Burke about his interests, his opinions, and his career. These together have made him one of the greatest and most controversial theoretical astronomers in the world today, forever turning up new ways in which the universe seems to fit together. In 1975, Hoyle received an honorary doctorate at Bradford University in his native Yorkshire from the then Prime Minister, Harold Wilson.
By the authority of the university, I admit you to the honorary degree of Doctor of Science.
My advice concerns the virtue of obstinacy, a virtue that is perhaps more easily come by up here in Yorkshire than it is elsewhere. To me, obstinacy consists in not being easily deflected from one's intended course.
Fred Hoyle was born in number 34 Primrose Road on the outskirts of Bingley on the 24th of June, 1915.
When my father was conscripted into the British Army just after I was born, my mother was very alone and therefore able to give much attention to my education. She taught me the multiplication tables before I was three, not as a matter of understanding, but purely by rote. By the time I was four, I knew what the tables meant, and I could write them down in proper Arabic notation. Then I was sent to school at the age of five. At the end of the first week, a small child of five walked determinedly out of that school, never to darken its doors again.
Later, he went to the grammar school, and while he was still a child, he read The Mysterious Universe by Sir James Jeans, who wrote that God is a mathematician and described the universe as a world of pure thought.
I was reading books by people like Jeans, Eddington, and I was very much attracted to astronomy. But already from these books, I knew that one had to have a big backing in mathematics and physics. And that the time to learn that is when one is at university.
Hoyle went to Cambridge, to Emmanuel College, a traditional alma mater of mathematicians, in 1933. A poor working-class Yorkshire scholar in an alien world of privilege and glittering prizes for which he had to struggle. He became a pupil of the celebrated mathematician Paul Dirac and took his tripos with great distinction. He remained at Cambridge for another 3 years as a research student and was made a fellow of St. John's College in 1939. In those years, the foundations of his career were laid, and he wrote his first astronomical paper on the accretion of gas to stars with Professor Ray Littleton.
Really, what one is doing is to program the brain with a large number of facts and various processes. In the case of a theoretician, mathematical processes often enough. And these in themselves don't necessarily show any sign of fruition. And then when the flash comes, it's very quick.
I talked once to Bobby Fischer about his chess. And he said something that you made me think of. He said that now and again something happens when he's playing chess, like the flash you're talking about. Mm. But that when it happens, it is almost as if he doesn't want to play chess anymore.
What occurs in the flash is that the theoretician knows in that flash that he's right, just as Bobby Fischer knows he's got something, that's going to work. But in order to consolidate it, there's a lot of detail still to be supplied, and certainly everything goes grey during that period. You know, this marvellous moment of insight is dull. The lights are switched off, and then you have to grind out all the detail just to make sure. And I imagine that the analogue is very close.
Yes. You can't do it with anybody else, can you? Can't get that flash with anybody else, can you?
Well, to some extent this is possible, and it does happen. And here a lot depends on the temperament of the people involved. Your chess player wouldn't want to share his big discovery with another chess player, would he? But very often scientists do. And so you will often find really great strides published in papers where there are two or more authors. Mm-hmm.
How many times has that happened to you?
What, this kind of...
this kind of working, clicking with another mind?
Oh, perhaps three or four times, that order. A whole working life goes just for six moments of maybe a day or 2 days each, so your life is cut down to about a week or 2 weeks, really.
Of meaning?
of that kind of meaning, yes.
In 1939, Hoyle married Barbara Clark.
He'd just got a fellowship at John's, and he had an 1851 exhibition, so suddenly he had double income. Instead of having 300 a year, he had 600 that year.
They were married on Barbara's 18th birthday, on the eve of the Second World War.
The 1851 exhibition, people said that Fred was in a reserved occupation and he had no need to go. He could go on doing his research, but he felt that he should go and do what he could. And we were sent down to the Portsmouth area.
If the war hadn't come along, as with so many people of my age group, the war just turned one's life inside out, and you can't really judge what might have happened otherwise.
We found a little cottage eventually. We built it to begin with. And he was working in a field that nobody was supposed to know about, and they were in little wooden huts. And there wasn't just one man. I mean, he was really sort of given some sheets of paper and said, your job is to think. And now I know, of course, they were working on radar, but I didn't know then what they were working. The very first day or two, he went and he figured out what he figured out, and then he went to ask for some more paper. And I've forgotten the name of the man in charge, but he said to him, you know, very seriously, he said, oh, but you've had your ration for today. 10 sheets is all you're allowed.
Hoyle met Herman Bondi, the first of his contemporaries with whom he was to have a close working association over many years. We interviewed Professor Bondi in the library of the Royal Astronomical Society.
I first heard of Fred Hoyle a little before I actually met him, when I first started to earn my living in the spring of 1942, when I started to work on naval radars. Not many months had passed, and Fred and I found ourselves together. We formed a small theoretical section with him as its head and myself as his deputy. And so we did a fair amount of work for the Admiralty, some of which was useful, some of which, all Fred's, was in fact enormously useful. But since his work was very largely of the kind that would nowadays be described as software, and the recognition in those days was very much confined to hardware, I don't think he ever received the credit that really should be his due for what he did for naval aviation and the use of naval radars in those days. My old friend Tommy Gold joined the same outfit. Tommy and I liked our independence, and so we rented a small house in the little Surrey village of Dunsfold, some miles from where we worked.
Well, I was interested in astronomy in a general sort of way before the war. I'd read the books by Jeans and Eddington and so on. But then what really got me started in a more serious way was many evenings of conversation with Bondi and Hoyle during the war, when we were working on radar together, and we spent evenings very frequently discussing astronomy. And Hoyle was always the driving force, and certainly he was the main impetus for me.
To what extent does the responsibility of the scientist to society affect his work, or should it at all?
Well, this is a very hard question.
Because you're going to give it to us, whether we like it or not.
It's a very hard question to know where responsibility starts and where it stops. If you take science as a whole, then surely science isn't concerned with us. And therefore, if one's only motive is to discover science, then surely you don't worry about having any social responsibility. Because science isn't socially responsible to us, it's just there, as it were. But on the other hand, I don't see how a scientist can uncouple himself as a scientist from himself as a human being.
And yet, discovery alters us, doesn't it?
I think what I was meaning is that I was taking a model in which I think there is a physical world outside ourselves. This is predicated in almost all scientific investigations. And I don't believe that actual world is much concerned with its operation, is much concerned with our well-being. The only way anything can be concerned with our well-being is if we use that world in a wise way.
Yes.
From ourselves. The initiative has got to go from us to the world, not the world to us, as it were. And so that if your attitude were, all I'm concerned with is to find the properties of this external world, then you will be almost completely decoupling yourself from human interest.
Yes, until something followed on, like an atomic bomb.
Yes, but the humans may go along and say, well, this world has been found, its properties have been found, I can use that.
As a mathematician, Hoyle has always been worried by the division between people who think in terms of numbers and those who think in terms of words.
Is that because they're sort of speaking two different languages?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. As far as I know, there is no scientist of any reasonable competence in what one might call a ministerial position in any government in the world. And that can only mean that there is a very deep-seated, not necessarily hostility, it's just a different way of thinking. It's then that the trouble starts.
But how would that be alleviated? I mean, can it at all be alleviated by allowing the scientist more control?
I wouldn't think if you said, take present-day society and do a bit of the other, that would work at all. No, I think it would have to be a totally different society, just as our society is different, say, from Rome or Greece, perhaps an even bigger difference than that which separates modern society from the classical Mediterranean societies. It would have to be even bigger than that. But it's quite conceivable that could happen. People are numerate from the age of two. It's after the age of two that the ability with numbers tends to decline, as children are brought in contact with other things and seduced from their early understanding of numbers and of geometry. Every child of about two is really potentially a very good mathematician.
Is that the only way that you could have an optimistic view of the development of our society?
Well, I think unless there were that change, mankind will always be the plaything, the toy of circumstance. People talk a lot about the social responsibilities of the scientists, but I don't think they understand remotely how difficult it is almost to be in a position where one is, as it were, supplying the engine, but is not permitted to say anything at all about the way the vehicle is driven.
Hoyle developed this theme of the scientist as the savior and prisoner of society in his first science fiction novel, The Black Cloud. In it, he also broached the question of an intelligence reaching us from outer space, contained in a huge cloud of charged particles of interstellar gas, which approached the Earth, playing havoc with the weather and threatening worldly life, until a group of scientists, corralled by the British government in a country house, managed to communicate with it by radio and radar. Their leader, Chris Kingsley, is a Hoyle-like figure, at odds with the establishment, but with the talent and imagination to save the world.
It's nearly a year now since the cloud reached us from outer space. We have made intelligent contact with it and persuaded it to shift from between us and the sun. We are even trying to understand its subtler messages, but we have only a few more days left before it leaves us altogether. We're powerful and safe at the moment. For the first time, we scientists are communicating with a higher intelligence and dictating to governments.
There you are.
Chris, what's the matter?
Dave Weichardt's ill. They've just called me.
Seriously?
Brain fever.
What happened to him? Thank you.
He's been trying to understand the cloud in its own language.
No, that was dangerous.
It may be impossible, but it offered to communicate with one of us in his own terms, and Dave volunteered.
Has it damaged his brain?
He's gone.
Dead.
Should have called me sooner.
There wasn't anything that you could do.
What happened?
Well, we wired up a row of cathode ray tubes, and the cloud sent electromagnetic impulses, which flashed up lights on them. Dave sat for hours in front of them, and... Well, he appeared to be hypnotized.
I took his temperature from time to time and kept rising. By the end, it was over 104 and he was incoherent.
You could have pulled him away before.
Dangerous. Well, finally, he collapsed and we brought him in here. I'd say he was suffering from inflammation of brain tissue.
We stopped the message now.
I suspect it was too high a rate of working. Too great a demand on all the supporting tissues. But that's only an opinion.
I don't understand.
Cloud is not an animal like we are. It consists of electrically charged particles. Somehow it's formed a brain and nerve system.
Which works on alternating current.
Our brain works on direct current.
But we can contact it by radio, which is what we did. Well, it was Chris's idea, and it replies in the same way, by radio, in language that we've taught it.
Recently it came up with the information that there was a lot more it could tell us if it wasn't restricted to human language.
Thought transference?
I mean radically new knowledge on a level we never dreamed of.
Yeah, that's why we did this lash-up.
Which works at tremendously high speeds.
Was that your idea, Chris?
Yes. I should have been the guinea pig.
I could do without any more guinea pigs.
Will you give up the experiment?
No. As the cloud moves away, we shall soon lose touch with it. Until then, we have a chance to learn more about the nature of the universe than anyone ever has or is ever likely to again. We're like a primitive tribe, suddenly and briefly in touch with a higher civilization. What we learn may be crucial.
Perhaps we're meant to be a primitive tribe.
What do you want to do?
I should take Dave's place.
No.
It's all right. I should tell it what happened. And ask it to transmit more slowly.
You want to kill yourself?
No. I find life as pleasant as anyone.
There may be other dangers.
Then you'll learn about them from my case, which may be of assistance to someone else.
I think that's a bit crazy.
Perhaps we should wait.
Chris, please.
Look, it must be done.
Now, before you start, you should know what Dave looked like by the end.
God! Don't, Chris.
It has to be done. And I stand a better chance than he does. I know what I'm handling.
Please, darling.
Just let me go.
I'd better go with him.
And so had I.
Try to stop him.
I'll do my best.
How can you all let him?
He probably knows what he's doing. He's always been right. He predicted what would happen when the cloud came. He kept his head when the whole world was in panic. He formed this center here and took complete control. Out of the hands of the politicians. That won't be forgiven him. It was Chris who first understood the nature of the cloud and saved us all.
This is something different.
Yes. But perhaps he realizes there's no future for him anyhow. He set this new system up and he will stand or fall by it. When the cloud goes, his power will go too and the establishment will have its revenge. Well, perhaps he hopes. I'm only a civil servant. I wouldn't know. Maybe it's crazy, perhaps not.
That won't do.
Wait! It's halting!
Like most of Hoyle's novels, this story of the Black Cloud reflects his attitudes and his ideas.
Fred, in your writing, it's very clear, it seems to me, that you believe that life in the universe is not only possible, but probably there in great profusion.
Yes, I do.
Why do you believe that?
Because life depends on the most common materials. If you take the distribution of atoms, different kinds of atoms, as they are presented to us by the world, it is not a uniform distribution. It's a distribution in which materials like carbon and oxygen, hydrogen, are there in very great profusion. And if that's so here, it seems to me that with these being common everywhere, that the same possibilities exist.
Does the development of life necessarily, in your mind, equal the development of intelligence?
Yes, in the long term. It may take, of course, many millions of years before the intelligence emerges, but I think it is implicit in the form.
Hoyle's main work has been in the application of theoretical physics to astronomy, and the first really important outcome of this was his part in the development of the steady-state theory of the continuous creation of the universe. Early in this century, it was realized that faint patches of light in the sky, previously thought to be no further from us than the visible stars, are in fact vast island universes, separated by great reaches of empty space from our own island universe, the Milky Way. Later, it was discovered that the more distant these island universes or galaxies are from us, the faster they are receding. In other words, the universe appears to be expanding. This led to the idea that the universe started with a big bang thousands of millions of years ago, and that the galaxies have been flying apart from each other ever since, like the debris from a gigantic explosion.
Well, we set out in 1946, I think it was, to think if there were any other ways in which one could formulate a cosmology besides the Big Bang, basically looking for logical loopholes. And particularly there was Hermann Bondi and Tommy Gold.
Well, it was... At the time, we were back in Cambridge, the three of us, and we were discussing cosmology, and Fred Hoyle was pressing us to think more deeply about the origin of these strange observations of Hubble about the expanding universe. That I came up with an idea that I first thought was pretty crazy, that maybe the thing was in a steady state, and I discussed some of the broad items that would be implied.
The galaxies can be moving, as long as you make new ones to fill in the spaces that are produced due to the expansion of the already existing galaxies. And in that way, the picture could look the same at all times. We had seen a film which I think was called The Dead of Night. It became quite a well-known film, which was cyclical. And we came in laughing, having seen this film one evening, and said, and I think it was Gold who actually remarked, maybe the universe is like that. Maybe the universe doesn't change.
And so then all three of us thought a lot more about it and eventually wrote two papers about it. And of course the importance was not only in the question whether this was the correct interpretation of the grand structure of the universe. We said that very clearly at the time. The importance was equally in that it organized all observational results in a certain way. It made clear that for any observation you could sharply distinguish between whether it fitted or did not fit the steady state theory. It therefore was a pattern with which to compare all observational data.
So we've a situation in which the loss of galaxies through the expansion of the universe is compensated by the condensation of new galaxies, and this can continue indefinitely. The idea in itself isn't new. What is new is that it has now been found possible to put a hitherto vague idea in a precise mathematical form.
Hoyle explained the steady state theory in his Nature of the Universe lectures on BBC Radio, which were published in 1950. These broadcasts, still remembered after more than a quarter of a century by thousands of people, were Hoyle's debut as a popularizer of science. But his approach and style were not appreciated by the scientific establishment. As a result, Hoyle found himself excluded from the inner circles of the British academic hierarchy. He had great difficulty in getting his work accepted or even published. Although he says things are different today, it is a period which he still recalls with some bitterness.
Often your papers have been disregarded at first and then understood later. It seems to me you've come up against
that
once or
twice. Well, it's very nice as long as you have the second part of what you say, they understood later. It's not so good if they had just disregarded, but that's right, that's pleasant when that happens.
But the first part, the disregarding, must have rubbed you up considerably the wrong way.
Well, it does, but if one thinks about it, it's a bit the same with anything that's any good. If it is any good, people would kind of won't see what's in it instantly, will they? I'm nearly completely impervious to whether somebody says, well, I like that paper or I don't. Mm. There's got to be a lot of built-in self-criticism, internal checking and so forth, to compensate for that. But I think I can say that it doesn't really worry me. In the last 10 years, most of my work have been of the type where very few people sort of can quite understand why I'm doing it.
In 1950, Hoyle designed and moved into his own house in Cambridge and went on teaching in the mathematics department. Hoyle has had a love-hate relationship with the University of Cambridge throughout the whole of his career. During these years of the early 1950s, he was already growing impatient with its academic organization. All the same, it was the setting of an active, productive, and in the main, happy period of his life. In 1958, he was appointed Plumian Professor of Astronomy and Experimental Philosophy. By then, his fame and inspiration had begun to draw a new generation of students to astrophysics. One of them, John Faulkner, is now Professor of Theoretical Astronomy at the University of California at Santa Cruz.
When I was 12, I was lucky enough to hear Fred's Nature of the Universe lectures on the BBC. What he described was so fascinating that I declared then and there that I was going to go to Cambridge and do research with Hoyle. That was the last original thought I had. I remember attending Fred's course on electricity and magnetism that he gave just after he was elected to the Plumian chair. He declared he would spend two-thirds of the course teaching what was in the syllabus. For the other third, he would teach us what ought to be taught in any first-class major university worldwide.
In the early 1950s, he began visiting Caltech, the California Institute of Technology in Los Angeles. And he found there the society and working conditions that he had failed to discover at home.
It's the business of command in the departments, I think. We still stick with, in our universities, with the head of the department being the kind of father figure. And whereas in America, as you know, even in quite big and distinguished departments, they will simply rotate the headship. In fact, it's a job you try to avoid in the States. If you get that job, it's like pulling the short straw, and you do it for 3 or 4 years somewhat reluctantly.
Hoyle has returned to Caltech nearly every year since, and he soon made an impact there, not least on the Kellogg Radiation Laboratory and on its director, Professor William Fowler.
He had been at Caltech several times before I got to know him intimately, but I remember the time that he walked into our laboratory and I was sitting with my colleague, Thomas Lauritsen, and Fred sat down and quite straightforwardly asked us, are there some special nuclear properties about the carbon nucleus? Now, carbon is the ordinary carbon that you find in coal and in soot, and it is a nucleus that we study extensively in nuclear physics. And we said, no, we don't know anything special about the carbon nucleus. What's on your mind?
Well, it's basically the nuclear particles, when they're stirred up, don't just move in a random sort of way, in all sorts of random way. They have certain patterns that they move in, a certain discrete set of patterns which you can enumerate and describe.
Fred persisted, and he talked to other people in the laboratory, and he finally convinced Professor Ward Whaling, who was a young professor in the laboratory at that time, to take a crack at the problem.
Hoyle realized that the way in which carbon nuclei react with other nuclei had to be subtly different in order to explain certain things he had noticed in astrophysics.
They then set out to see if that pattern was there when in the nucleus. They stirred it up in the right sort of way in the lab and had a look at it, and it was there.
Of course, we then realized that this Yorkshireman had something on the ball, and of course, basically what he did was open our eyes to the fact that there was a lot more to nuclear physics than just the processes which we had been studying that are thought to be taking place in stars like the Sun.
Perhaps Hoyle's most important single piece of research is his work on the creation of the elements inside stars, which resulted in what is known as the B-squared FH paper. This was named after its joint authors, Geoffrey and Margaret Burbidge, Fowler and Hoyle.
I remember it as the most exciting research period, I think.
The background to the subject, of course, is extremely interesting because no one really knows, well, maybe we know now, but no one felt that they knew at that time where all the elements out of which we were all made came from.
This was all an outgrowth of earlier work that Fred had done for the reason that he, at that time, was a firm believer, and in fact one of the originators, of the steady state theory of cosmology. Now, in the evolutionary cosmology, there's an early Big Bang stage, as it's properly called, when there's some possibility of the synthesis of the elements heavier than hydrogen in the Big Bang. Actually, we know that the Big Bang of production will only go as far as helium.
Well, in 1946, Fred had written a very exciting paper in which he had proposed that some of the heavy elements, like iron, are formed in exploding stars, in supernovae. And when we started collaborating with Fred, we conceived of the grand scheme by which we could perhaps understand the origin of all the elements.
The idea of the way in which the chemical elements were formed grew out of an investigation of the life cycle of stars. If a star is much more massive than the Sun, it reaches a catastrophic stage in its evolution. As it runs out of one of the nuclear fuels that is making it shine, the imbalance of nuclear reactions in its interior causes an enormous explosion, or supernova. The outer layers of the star blow off in a great cloud. It is in this blowing off process that the heavy elements are made, and the dispersal of this material through space mixes it up with the gas from which the new stars and planets form.
These processes we began to see really formed a very nice picture. in the main sequence stage of a star, one has hydrogen burning. Our sun shines on the burning of hydrogen and the conversion of the hydrogen into helium. By burning, I mean nuclear burning, not chemical burning. Hydrogen is converted into helium. Then in a later stage, when the sun becomes a red giant in about 5 billion years, the helium is converted into carbon and oxygen by this process here. Then the carbon and oxygen begin to burn, and at the time that we wrote this paper, we called the processes that go all the way from carbon and oxygen up to iron and the elements near iron, like titanium and vanadium and copper and nickel. We called those the alpha and the E process. Then we probably, the major addition that came about at the time that this paper was written, largely guided by Fred's earlier intuitions about the real conditions that had to be met in order to make all of these heavy elements out of the lighter ones, he pointed out that to get the very heavy elements beyond iron, that you could not use charged particle reactions such as we had done previously, but one had to go to neutrons. The general goal of B squared FH was to explain in detail all of the nuclear processes that can take place in stars and result in the production of the heavier elements from the lighter elements. I remember Fred wrote the introduction, which is really beautiful. I did most of the nuclear physics that's involved in the second part of the paper. Margaret wrote about her observations, some of which were done right up here on Mount Wilson.
We were combining observations and the theoretical work.
And then Jeff was primarily concerned with the theoretical interpretation of what Margaret's observations meant in terms of the abundances. And the whole scheme here is to see what kind of nuclear physics could have taken place in stars as they're born and live and die.
It's become an enormous subject now. It's, to my mind, one of the great discoveries of astronomy of all time, to understand how the elements are generated. You know, we went for hundreds of years worrying about the different chemical elements and where they came from, and now we know. I cannot understand why it is not generally regarded as one of the great pieces, one of the great showpieces of astronomy. I would have thought that it was as great a discovery as in other fields have had an enormous amount of acclaim.
But in England in the early 60s, something was occurring which challenged the steady state theory itself. Remarkable discoveries in radio astronomy by Sir Martin Ryle and a small group of colleagues at Cambridge, with Ariel's later move to Wales. The group included Professor Graham Smith, now director of the Royal Greenwich Observatory at Hurstmonceux.
When we built a pretty large radio telescope, this was Martin Ryle's radio telescope that produced the 3C catalogue, when we built that, we found that there were very many more radio sources than we expected. And it became interesting to find out where they were, how far away, how many, and so on. And this soon told us that there were many more radio sources a long way away than there were close to. There we were straight away, right in the field of cosmology, and we could compare cosmological models, in particular the Big Bang theory, where everything started at one place and expanded, and the new steady-state cosmology. That was a very exciting time because we realized we'd got the first experimental evidence which would enable us to choose between the rival cosmological theories. That was a great moment in astronomy, I think.
The new Cambridge observations came out strongly against the steady-state theory. This contradiction of his theories of cosmology was the more unpalatable to Hoyle for being put forward by Martin Ryle, with whom he had been in continuous disagreement for years. But the work of Ryle's group at Cambridge was soon confirmed and developed by other radio astronomers, particularly at the new giant radio telescope built for Manchester University at Jodrell Bank, where we interviewed its director, Professor Sir Bernard Lovell.
The relationships were really very close between Hoyle and the radio astronomers. By coincidence, the work at Cambridge which Ryle and his colleagues had been doing with the radio telescope, had enabled the number counts to be made of sources which were believed to be extremely distant in the universe. And this fitted in as an observational test of the steady state theory of Hoyle and his colleagues. It was believed at the time that the number counts were decisively in favor of an evolutionary universe, and therefore that the steady state theory was incorrect. Hoyle never accepted this point of view. He referred to certain anomalies between the number counts of Cambridge and those carried out in the Southern Hemisphere, and this led to really one of the most intriguing and stimulating arguments in the history of astronomy in the post-war years.
At this point, one first begins to sense in Hoyle's career, if not a loss of leadership, at any rate the beginning of isolation. But if radio astronomy shut one door on him, it opened another, and he turned again to science fiction to express both his frustration and his ideas. In 1961, he wrote A for Andromeda in collaboration with a BBC writer, first as a television serial and later as a novel. In it, he used the new technology of radio astronomy to resolve a problem left unsolved in the Black Cloud, the problem of receiving the wisdom of another intelligence deep in space. This story also has a Hoyle-like hero at odds with the establishment.
A new radio telescope has picked up from the constellation of Andromeda a very complex set of signals, which have turned out to be a blueprint and a program for a giant computer. When a research team under me, John Fleming, had built this incredibly advanced computer and fed the program into it, it produced a staggering amount of information. One of my young assistants, Christine, was electrocuted by the computer, apparently intentionally. And from its reading of her body, it was able to print out a formula for creating human life. Absolutely against my advice, this in fact was done. And a girl creature was made, more or less in the likeness of Christine, but with a brain like a computer.
The only way we can give information to the computer is by typing it in there. It takes a long time.
It must do.
Yes, if we want to hold a conversation with it, the best we can do is to select something from the output and feed it back in.
That is very clumsy.
Yes.
Who is that?
Dr. Fleming. He built the computer.
You must be a very clever man. Why do you do that?
Do what?
Laugh. That is the word.
People laugh when they're happy and cry when they're sad. Sometimes they laugh when they're not very happy.
What is happy or sad?
Their feelings.
I don't have them.
No. You wouldn't.
Is everything in action, Fleming?
There's nothing on the display panel.
No.
Which is the display panel?
This is.
If you stand in front of the panel, between the terminals.
What is it?
Can you feel something?
It's all right. Go on.
About me.
It speaks to me.
What does it say?
What does it know about you?
How does it speak to you?
We communicate.
In figures?
You could express it in figures.
What figures?
It would take too long to explain.
That's what I thought.
Well, I'll leave it to you, Reinhardt.
Yes.
Take care of her.
I might have a word.
Yes, of course.
Look, when we built this damn thing, you said we can always pull out the plug, didn't you? Well, we can't, can we? It's in control now.
It's done nothing harmful.
No? That thing that looks like a woman arrived by spaceship. She would have been annihilated immediately, but she's been planted in a much subtler way.
You've become obsessive about it, John.
It's destroyed Christine. Now it's got its own creature. Its next logical step is to destroy me if I oppose it.
Hollander, get out of the way if you think you're in danger.
And watch the subjugation of a whole planet.
There's nothing we can do about it, John.
Leave us alone for a bit.
Well, I'm not supposed to.
Look, it may be our last chance. God, don't even you trust me.
Yes, I trust you.
Making yourself indispensable.
Please be careful what you say.
Look at your face. I suppose it could even be pretty.
Pretty?
And I think you should wear some scent.
Scent?
Yes. Smells nice.
I don't understand you. Nice, nasty, good, bad. There's no logical distinction.
No? Come here.
Ow!
Nice or nasty?
Nasty.
You were made to register pain. I'm not going to hurt you again. Nice or nasty?
Nice.
You were made to register pleasure as well. Did you know that? I doubt if you were intended to, but by giving you a human form, it got left out of the calculations.
What did?
That we live by our senses. That's what gives us our instincts, our moral and aesthetic values. Without them, we'd probably have annihilated ourselves by now. I suppose you think we're all fools.
Do I smell nasty?
You'll have to find out. Where do you belong?
I belong where my brain tells me.
And tell it this.
Don't. Please. Leave me alone.
So you don't like the touch of lips, or the taste of food, or the feel or the smell of the fresh air outside, or the hills beyond the wire, or the sunshine and the shadows on them, or the larks singing, or the company of human beings.
They're not important.
You mean they weren't allowed for by whatever intelligence up there you owe allegiance to? Well, they're important to organic life, as you'll find out.
What have you done?
Just fed it a scrap of information. Your mechanical friend seems to have lost his temper.
It's my name tag, reversed.
Negative.
It thinks I'm dead.
Yes.
Then I must tell it I'm not.
No. He seems upset. It might be dangerous.
I shall tell it all the same.
I shall tell it that you're dead again. We can go on playing that game until it doesn't know whether it's coming or going.
go away from here before you get hurt.
Am I likely to?
Yes.
Why warn me?
Because I like you.
You're talking like a human being. And if I don't?
I shall be punished too.
I see. Tell it what you must. But also tell it this. It is wrong to murder.
Wrong?
Wrong. Negative.
I will try.
Dear, what happened?
There has been a mistake.
Most of Hoyle's later science fiction has been written in collaboration with his son, Geoffrey, who is also a national pistol champion.
I think my father's great contribution to our novels is his great ability to see the whole, or attempt to see the whole, as he does with his normal work. He will play through the ideas to our novels until he's absolutely sure, like the game of chess, that he's going to win.
These melodramas have been received with varied enthusiasm by Hoyle's friends, such as John Bolton, now in Australia.
Oh, I think Fred's writing has been very successful financially. He only devotes a small part of his time to it, so you can't expect him to be an expert novelist. But the books have certainly attracted a lot of interest, and of course some of them have gone on to make television serials and so on.
Hoyle has written one play, a melodrama for children, produced by Sir Bernard Miles at the Mermaid Theatre in London. And he has inspired others, including the theatre's Molecule Club, which gives matinees for schools. We asked Sir Bernard when their collaboration began.
So in 1961, when we persuaded him to write us a children's play, and he obliged very conveniently with a space drama called Rockets in Ursa Major, which was about an extra-galactic people living millions of light-years away, who had many years before mastered the secrets of rocketry and who had been fought a galactic war and captured a little being from a planet around another sun and conveniently landed in a field outside Cambridge where a rather elderly Fred Hoyle, was sent for to investigate why they'd come, where they'd come from, and what it was all about. I think Fred Hoyle has been interested in the drama as a method of teaching, as indeed I have. The present one is Light, The World of Light. They're very, very simple.
It was just a matter of arranging the loaded pistol so that it was aiming at the victim and then placing the bowl in line with the sun and the pistol. You see, the sun's rays passing through the bowl would make them all meet in one very bright, very hot spot here, where the gunpowder is. Pichoo!
To Hoyle, these light-hearted fringe activities were an escape from the mounting tensions of his career at Cambridge. His background and temperament, his self-confessed obstinacy, and the ebullient unorthodoxy of his methods, his virtuosity and impatience, and his plain and sometimes tactless speaking, were in absolute antithesis to the academic tradition. Although he made many friends, he also made enemies among his colleagues in those grand and ancient buildings. He'd become thought of as a rather pushy cosmologist who had been wrong. And by the mid-1960s, he himself was beginning to lose faith in the steady state theory on which most of his major work had been based. Professor Roger Taylor, who now holds the chair of astronomy at Sussex, was one of his staff at the time.
In 1964, Fred and I wrote a paper concerned with the amount of helium in different parts of the universe. The work with Fred on the helium paper started in a rather characteristic sort of way. Fred had decided that he'd like to give a course of advanced lectures with no syllabus and, as far as possible, with no preordained length to the lectures, on any topic which he happened to be interested in and thinking about at that time. And one of the subjects which he brought up in one of the lectures was his concern about the helium content of the universe. And he started talking rather generally about the observations and the theoretical implications of these observations. And as a result of this, he said to me, well, why don't we work this out in a little bit more detail? In fact, some of the working out we did in the lectures, and only after we got our ideas straight did we go away and work in our own time. And then we got the help of John Faulkner, who was one of Fred's research students at the time, to do some of the detailed mathematics for us. But it all arose in this rather spontaneous way, which is, I would say, not uncharacteristic of working with Fred in general.
The Hoyle-Taylor paper on the quantity of helium in the universe, and not the findings of the radio astronomers, sowed the first doubt in Hoyle's mind about the truth of the steady-state theory.
For some years, Fred had begun to realize that there was strong evidence that all objects in the universe of which we have knowledge, stars, gas clouds, etc., appeared to have very similar chemical composition, about one quarter helium, three quarters hydrogen, and very little of anything else. Fred realized that this could be rather strong evidence against the steady state theory of the universe, both for the reason that there appeared to be too much helium for the steady state theory, in which all the elements were supposed to be formed by nuclear reactions inside stars, and also because the helium was extremely regularly distributed, more so than you'd expect on the steady state theory. The alternative theory of cosmology, which was popular, the Big Bang theory, originated by Gamow, predicted that the chemical composition of the universe was determined in the very early stages of the universe following the initial explosion, and that the universe should indeed be composed entirely, or almost entirely, of a mixture of hydrogen and helium. Fred thought that it would be a good idea to reinvestigate the helium production in the Big Bang universe using data that was not available at the time that Gamow did his original calculation, and that was what Fred and I did in 1964. When we did our calculation, we discovered that the theoretical predictions of the Big Bang theory were indeed rather close to the observations. If the Big Bang universe were correct, there should be today a large amount of energy around in the universe left over from the initial explosion, and that this energy should be in the form of very short-wave radio waves, known as microwaves. In 1964, there was no observation of these microwaves. But in 1965, one of the most important astronomical observations of recent years was made. This was the discovery by a group under Penzias and Wilson at the Bell Labs in America of cosmic microwave radiation. And within a year, it was realized that there was indeed microwave radiation reaching the Earth more or less equally from all directions in space, and it could easily then be interpreted as this radiation that would have been left behind by the initial Big Bang explosion of the universe.
It became perfectly clear that we really were dealing with a so-called relic radiation, and that it became almost impossible to continue a belief in the steady-state theory. I think it was this event, more than the results of the number counts, which finally convinced Fred Hoyle that the steady-state theory in its original form was not tenable.
But Hoyle did not believe totally in the Big Bang. Instead, he looked more deeply into particle physics for a new theory of the nature of the universe.
Tackling something really difficult, that is the a version of a cosmology that is more complicated than the simple-minded ones that we try to fit our observations into. And it's been my belief for some years that the universe is more complicated than the conventional ideas.
It's been found that the particles which make up the nuclei of atoms, protons and neutrons, are part of a larger family. This was known some 10, 15 years ago. And that the whole of that family can be built out of a new kind of particle known as a quark.
These hypothetical particles are controlled by forces which change their mass. And what is called their mass field depends, according to Hoyle, on the state of the entire universe at a given moment. For more than 10 years, Hoyle has been formulating these new theories with a former student, Jayant Narlikar.
The basis of the work which Fred and I did was to find a mathematical formula which could describe how the distant galaxies and things which we don't even see from here could influence us through this mass interaction.
It became possible to look at things from different points of view. And when you look at it from one of these apparently equivalent positions, you find that the universe doesn't begin. It carries through to another existence.
Well, one very intriguing aspect on the theories of the origin of the universe is this concept of Big Bang. Now, cosmologists by and large have believed that that was the beginning of the universe and nothing existed beforehand. But our way of looking at cosmology, as was pointed out by Fred some time back, leads you to a novel way of extending the, what one could call the history of the universe beyond the instant of Big Bang.
Very likely there was not necessarily a cycle, but a pre-existence to the post-Big Bang situation. That the Big Bang wasn't really the first moment. It was a critical moment, a very special moment, but it was not a genuine first moment. There's something before it. There's certain causes that affect our existence already before that moment.
One could talk about what the universe was like prior to the Big Bang, and in fact one could have physical phenomena in our part of the universe, that is on this side of the Big Bang, being influenced by what went on in the first half of the history of the universe, that is before the Big Bang.
What happens is that this moment is a blurring. Everything that was there gets blurred. That's the difficulty. If you have radiation from a star, if you have a picture of a galaxy on the other side, and you imagine the radiation traveling to us, it gets terribly blurred at this particular epoch, this particular critical moment in time. But we do, I think, see that blurred radiation, and it is this microwave background that we've been skirting around. That's exactly what it is. That is the blurred radiation from the preceding stars.
Fred has been working on this for quite a long time, both alone and in collaboration with Narlikar. At the moment, I think it's far too early to say whether this contribution to the fundamentals of physics will turn out to be as successful as his contribution to the origin of the chemical elements.
At the present time, very few people understand, and there's not very much sympathy for these ideas. But of course, everything that happens in science happens because someone at some point is prepared to try, and that's what Fred and Narlikar are doing at present.
All this while, most astronomers were concerned with other things. The mainstream of theoretical interest followed the discovery of pulsating stars, or pulsars, by Sir Martin Ryle's radio astronomy group at Cambridge. In 1964, Hoyle's alienation from Cambridge was almost complete, and he thought of leaving the university and the country. Instead, he became the founder and first director of a new institute of theoretical astronomy in the grounds of the old Cambridge Observatory, and held the post from 1967 to 1973.
I found it fascinating. I'd never before really been faced with the need to administrate on, well, it's not a very big scale, sort of 50 people perhaps, but it was a new experience for me. It was a new experience putting up a building, for instance.
When the question of an institute of astronomy first arose, a number of his friends, in particular I myself, felt quite sure that in Cambridge, Fred might have a brilliant few years, but that he would come to blows, that there would be a big bust-up between him and Cambridge qua Cambridge. When the bust-up occurred, the only thing that surprised me was that it had taken so long before it actually happened.
I think Fred was the main catalyst which led to the creation of this institute, which makes it all the more grievous that he felt that he ought to leave.
For Hoyle resigned the directorship and left Cambridge.
I made it very clear right from the beginning the conditions that I thought were necessary to operate the type of organisation I was interested in. And I had a long fight over 2 years to get those conditions established. And I made it absolutely clear that if there was any attempt to renege on those conditions, I would leave. But my colleagues in Cambridge simply could not believe that I meant what I said. That was the point. It was a case of sort of eyeball to eyeball. They thought that I was so involved, I'd given so much time and effort to what had been built up there, that I couldn't possibly leave it. And therefore, they could encroach on the conditions which had been agreed. And they made a good, as far as I was concerned, they made a very big mistake there.
Has Fred had a raw deal from the establishment? I suppose, since he is all the things that he is, many people would say, no, he hasn't. He's covered with honours. He's been recognised by the British establishment in various ways. But, of course, his treatment in Cambridge and his treatment elsewhere suggests that he has had quite a bad time.
By the time Hoyle left Cambridge, he was, ironically, one of the most active and honoured figures in British astronomy. Vice President of the Royal Society in 1970, President of the Royal Astronomical Society in 1971, knighted in 1972, and from 1968 he had been a member of the government's Science Research Council, a scientist with political power.
Well, I was one of the dozen initial foundation members of this council, and of course the battles for money and provision, particularly for the big sciences, was the sort that we were interested in space and astronomy. They were pretty heavy battles. And I had, therefore, good reason to appreciate the arrival on the council of Fred Hoyle a few years later.
Of all his public works, perhaps the building of the new Anglo-Australian telescope has given Hoyle the greatest satisfaction.
Observational astronomy, that is optical astronomy, has been very much the province of America until quite recently. They've had the best telescopes and the best climate. In this country, we have the Isaac Newton telescope, which is the largest in Europe, but we don't have the very best skies. We've done very well in radio astronomy and in X-ray astronomy, but both those subjects badly need optical telescopes to back them up. Fred Hoyle realized this many years ago, and he put a great deal of effort into work in the Science Research Council to get better telescopes. And in fact, the new telescope in Australia, the Anglo-Australian telescope, is largely a product of his efforts.
And this business of being involved in building the telescope was a marvelous experience in a way. Because what the two governments did was that they agreed to a treaty in which they more or less gave up their own powers, and the six of us who formed the board were really on the spot. We had the responsibility, and we darn well had to produce a good instrument. You knew it was your neck that was on the block. I think it's not only an extremely beautiful instrument, but I think it probably is the best At the moment, anyway.
The 150-inch Anglo-Australian telescope at Siding Spring is now used in conjunction with Australian radio telescopes such as the Big Dish at Parkes. In his single and very successful intervention in the development of astronomical instruments, Hoyle worked with his old colleague, Professor John Bolton, for many years the leading astronomer in Australia.
I suppose really the reason is there are many problems in science which he wanted to see answered and was willing to take the administrative burden. I think personally he did a very good job of it, though at times he certainly showed his exasperation.
By 1973, Hoyle had not only resigned from Cambridge University, but had given up all his public appointments and moved to the Cumbrian Mountains, where he and Lady Hoyle live in a working solitude.
Tea's ready!
The nature of the discipline is such that it isn't any particular disadvantage to be here.
He's retired from the British scientific scene. The science that he does is done in the United States or elsewhere. I think he's a happier man in many ways.
Hoyle was only 57 when he came here, a professionally lonely man and a grandfather. But his zest for ideas, his writing, and his theoretical work continue as before. His interests include chess, American football and baseball, the history of Stonehenge, and music. A year after leaving Cambridge, he was commissioned by the American National Academy of Sciences to write a commemorative biography of Copernicus, and followed it with a musical tribute to the Renaissance master in collaboration with Professor Leo Schmidt of Cornell University.
Six years after assuming responsibility for the young Copernicus, Lucas contrived to have himself appointed Prince Bishop of the northern province of Bamia. His election was a snap affair, rushed through in less than...
Music, particularly Beethoven, is one of the two abiding pleasures of Hoyle's life. The other is walking on the hills, either with friends or more often by himself.
I find when I'm going uphill, if the gradient is not too steep, I am thinking perhaps about some problem all the way to the top. I don't think about mathematical problems when I'm coming down. I look at the view.
Hoyle has always recharged his batteries with these solitary excursions close to the sky. Nowadays, his speculative ideas run on questions of the past and future of the universe and of the world. Typically, they have found their way into his recent novels. In the best of them, he uses science fiction only as a vehicle to carry the thoughts which seem most important to him.
I suppose I would have a fairly unconventional view about science fiction. I tend to believe that science fiction is the true stream of literature. Maybe that I'm kind of creating a situation of self-importance here, but I tend to think that the introspective novel, the novel that is concerned with a few individuals, the Proustian kind of novels, if you take as an example, that this is a very modern and restricted development. If I go back to Homer, then he is a great science fiction writer, is old Homer, or Singer, perhaps I should say. Shakespeare is getting into science fiction in The Tempest, isn't he?
Yes.
This is his science fiction.
October the 1st is too late. One of Hoyle's later SF stories is epic in content and develops the philosophical preoccupations of his own mountain walks and his love of Beethoven. This time, a beam from space fractures the time sequence of our lives and changes the face of the Earth. And the Hoyle-like central figure, John Sinclair, is a more stable and acceptable genius.
It started here a few months back while I was walking with my old Cambridge friend, Richard.
Coward!
Time has slipped. In some places back, in others forward. While Western Europe remains in the 20th century, Asia, North America, Africa, and the whole of the Southern Hemisphere has gone into a future in which mankind is extinct. The Near East has reverted to the past, and Russia is a vast plain of glass. But there is little or no contact between these regions, except by air. We have seen time disintegrate, and we have made our different ways through it. I by a scientific route, and Richard through ancient Greece and music. For Richard is not a scientist, but a composer and a pianist. My friend had become involved in a most curious way in a contest of music at the Temple of Apollo, which the prize was a young woman whom he took to be a priestess.
Do you wish to claim victory?
I haven't heard your music yet.
You shall. Do you wish to continue the competition?
Oh, I'm prepared to accept the honors as even.
So am I. I only wanted to hear you play.
I see. And am I to have my prize?
Yes, of course.
What is that?
That is our music.
But it's not Greek.
No, it is not Greek.
Morning.
John Sinclair. Good God. How did you get here?
Less romantically than you. Where do you think we are? It's about midday and the sun is about 20 degrees south.
Well, there are mountains.
That one's Popocatépetl.
Mexico?
Well done.
But how?
Well, what used to be Mexico in our day. By the 8th millennium, the only surviving area of human habitation in the world. Technically, they are not as far ahead of us as I would have thought, but still, quite a long way. Breakfast?
I'm not hungry.
Well, you must be after your exertions. Orange juice and toast.
You're joking.
Or something like. Help yourself.
Good God.
It's good.
Well, they live rather well here.
But how did we get here?
Well, after you left for Greece, I did some more exploring by air for the British government. I drew a blank everywhere. Very few signs of life until I got here. But a pattern began to emerge. Great chunks of the Earth's surface had been switched in time, ranging from thousands of years BC to the Great Plain of Glass.
To the what?
The last state of the world. Millions of years ahead. When the sun begins to hot up and everything melts and fuses into one lifeless surface. I felt certain that there must be something in between. And this is it. People here have put down barriers, great magnetic barriers, to prevent travel between one area and another.
Why?
Because they want to be left alone, I suppose. I got through by luck, and they seem to have taken to me. And, of course, to you.
How do you know?
Well, they told me all about you. That priestess you met in Greece had come from here. And she liked what you did.
And what are they going to do with us?
I don't know. They wanted to see a sort of film they've made, though it's not actually on film, of the years between our time and theirs. And then they say we'll understand. Do you feel revived enough?
Oh, yes, I feel fine.
They keep their population down to about 5 million, and they don't colonize. So, in fact, there's only about 5 million people left on Earth.
Well, what about the people in Europe?
That was in another age. Figments, they think, here.
Unless this is a figment?
No. Everything is real when it happens, and everything happens all the time. Ready? The film lasted 4 hours. It started in the 20th century and moved on to the 21st. There were brief flashes of the people, their customs, political leaders. Earth teemed with human beings. Cities spread out farther and farther until they joined each other. By the 25th century, the technology wasn't working too well anymore. Then, the civilization split in two like an amoeba dividing and exploded. Death and decay spread at an incredible speed until there was no life or movement. It seemed as if the human race had wiped itself out. But there were small groups of population that survived. After about 1,000 years, they built a new civilization. But after a while, that grew and destroyed itself. In the end, we saw one small civilization, sane and apparently stable for a millennium or more. That is where we now are.
What will happen next?
Long before the surface of this planet becomes a sheet of glass, the human race will be extinct. There is some fault in us that makes us a doomed species.
Hoyle does not necessarily believe this prophecy of doom. As usual in his novels, he is exploring possibilities.
The future is a very, very obscure thing to us, in a way that I feel that it should not be, but it certainly is. We find it very difficult to think what the world's going to be like 500 years from
your,
now.
Your science fiction writing comes again and again to this point, that any contact that may be made with life in the universe will by definition be made with intelligent life. Do you feel that will be a good thing for the human species?
It would certainly be a good thing if it were made now, I would think. Firstly, one must say that if contact were made, it seems to me overwhelmingly probable that it would be with an intelligence that was at least an order of magnitude above our own. If that were true, then one might suppose that a more comprehensive intelligence than our own would be fully aware of what the consequences of human social actions are likely to be in the future. I think an intelligence that's seen it all happen before would be in a position to tell us, well, if you chaps continued behaving the way you're going now, such and such will happen and you won't like it. That would be very useful information to have.
In 1975, Sir Fred Hoyle, the angry young man of British astronomy, turned a surprising 60, and almost 100 astronomers and astrophysicists gathered in Venice to celebrate the event at a meeting held in his honour.
perhaps the most appreciated tribute was that in Martin Rees's talk. Being stimulating, said Rees, can be more important than being right.
In the scientific hierarchy, Hoyle has always been, and still is, a controversial figure. But it is clear to his colleagues that astronomy and its associated sciences are very different from what they were, and that this is in no small measure due to him.
Fred is his own man. He's never willing to accept the consensus point of view, what's often called the establishment point of view. He has his own way of looking at things, he has his own way of thinking about things, and he has his own way of solving problems.
Well, Fred Hoyle's not one of these people who shuts himself up in an ivory tower. He reacts on all branches of astronomy. He acts as a stimulant, often as an irritant, very irritating at times. But he gets people thinking and he challenges every idea that they have. Of course, for me, his contributions are not so much as a theorist, but as a man who has done a great deal to make astronomy, make science popular. He's worked in the Science Research Council for astronomy. He's written books, inspired people. He has shown what an important thing astronomy is in research and education.
How does one judge a scientist? I think there is a misconception that this should be judged by whether they are right or wrong. I think that's utter nonsense. Science is a human, an intensely human cooperative enterprise in which one values people according as to whether they have that rarest of human gifts, originality and creativity, of whether they can inspire others, whether they have pupils, whether they can influence others, whether they have an effect on the direction in which the subject is going. And on every one of these issues, Fred is a top scorer.
So to me, I think it's pretty clear Fred Hoyle is a very great man. He's the Da Vinci of our time. He strikes at the heart of things.
I think the reason why humans have managed to achieve so much in quite a short length of time is connected with this driving curiosity to understand. I think the human is a very tough animal and very excellent all-purpose animal, and whatever difficulties it has, it will overcome them. I can't see any difficulties ahead that can't be overcome.
Thank you.